From PRI and WNYC, this is the podcast of Studio 360, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversations about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support Studio 360 by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more. Studio 360's podcast is supported by Herman Miller and Design Within Reach, working together to foster a greater appreciation of authentic modern designs for the home.
Today in Studio 360, we hunker down in survival mode.
The crew of the Yankees coming!
Scarlett O'Hara endures the Civil War.
As God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again.
The novelist Richard Ford is back to test his protagonist with every conceivable midlife crisis.
He has cancer, his wife has abandoned him. All of these things are swirling around him.
And our studio is mostly intact after the rocker Courtney Love blows through.
Can I just have coffee because I'm going to die?
Okay.
How hard is it to get coffee? We're in New York. It's like Coffee Central.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's all ahead in Studio 360 today, right after this.
I just need some coffee. Baby.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. It takes years for Richard Ford to write a novel. His newest, The Lay of the Land, has been germinating for a decade. He told us a couple of years ago that he spent so much time gathering material and reworking his manuscript that he kept his pages as they were finished in his fridge for safekeeping. If the house burned down, he figured the freezer would be the safest place. Well, he eventually took those pages out of the freezer, and now Richard Ford is here with me today to talk about his new novel, The Lay of the Land. Richard, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you, Kurt. Glad to be here. Thanks a lot. I should tell you, you know, I did keep my manuscript in the freezer, and the last week I was working on it, which is about the middle of August, I left my workroom where I worked, and I left my manuscript under a halogen lamp, and it fell down on my manuscript and set it on fire. So
you made your greatest fear come true.
I did, without really wanting to.
And was any irreparable destruction done?
When I got back in the room, it was all full of smoke and the manuscript was flickering, but all the editor marks, most of which I had made, were intact and we could put it back together.
There's something fictional and metaphorical about that very event.
It just means I didn't really want to do it, right?
I wouldn't even say that. Let's back up a bit and give some context for this novel. The Lay of the Land is the last book of a trilogy about the life of Frank Bascom. In the first book, the sports writer, Frank's life is a shambles. Son has died, his marriage and his career as a novelist have failed. Then a decade later, in Independence Day, which I should note won the Pulitzer Prize, Frank becomes a real estate agent, and he's still got marriage and family and children problems. So now, in The Lay of the Land, Frank is older, as we all are, and is still selling real estate. How has he changed?
Well, I think he's funnier, at least the stuff that I had to put in the book incited in me humor because some of it is dark. He has cancer. His former wife has decided she's in love with him again, which is horrifying to him. His kids have grown up to be not what he would have expected, which probably happens to everyone who has kids. And his wife has abandoned him. And so all of these things are swirling around him, just as you say, at the beginning of this, at the beginning of the Thanksgiving season, which is always full of morbidities anyway, as far as I'm concerned.
And putting stresses on certain fissures in the natural family scheme.
Exactly. Which the book uses as challenges for him to reconcile and accommodate. I mean, that's when I started off writing these books, my wife said to me, she said, why don't you write a book about somebody who's happy? You had never done that before. And so my way of understanding how you write about somebody who's happy is you encounter someone who's just like the rest of us, but who may be trying harder to make himself happy and not complaining about life. And in fact, trying hard to make the cards that he's dealt playable cards.
The book, The Lay of the Land, is set in 2000. As you were doing it, was it a big choice that you had to make of whether to put it before or after September 11th?
Yes.
Yeah?
It was a big choice. And I made the choice for two or three, I think, quite sound reasons. One was I didn't think I had the capacity to write a novel which was set in the aftermath of 2001. It just wasn't in my range.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
But you're one of the great American novelists, Richard.
Well, then I make great American decisions then, if that's the case. And this was one of them. I mean, for me, events have to, even if they aren't cataclysmic events like 9/11, events all around me have to settle into the ground around me and then sort of percolate back up through my feet. I'm always surprised when I think of something that I want to write about, because almost inevitably, it's something that I've known about for years.
Well, there's a scene about a cat getting run over in this book, which apparently has been in your head for many, many years.
That's exactly right. Once my mother in the front yard of our house in Jackson, Mississippi, in what must have been about 1950, ran over my cat. And she didn't know she ran over the cat and just backed out into the street and drove away. And I was left alone, 6 years old, at the house with this cat sort of in his death throes. And I picked the little cat up and I ran next door where there was this old Civil War veteran. You can imagine that. I know.
Yeah.
Sitting on the front porch.
A very old man.
A very, very, very old turkey-necked guy. And I ran up to him and I said, my cat's been run over. And he was, of course, addle-pated as could be. And he said to me, he said, I think you've got a Persian there. He said, but it looks like something's wrong with it. I've known that story all my life. Suddenly, a moment comes in the middle of this book that it seemed to fit in perfectly. And there it was.
That's interesting. That you have this sort of pantry of memories, and at the right moment, you'll go and get that thing from the pantry.
You could also say that the pantry was getting bare, so I was looking back behind the first row of cans now.
Having written this trilogy about Frank Bascom, do you feel as though that pantry is bare? You cleaned it out. You're happy to go on? Or are you going to miss having this armature for your imagination?
I don't think I'll miss it. I would really rather that things went on apace in another direction now. Yeah, I try to bring the whole institution of being a writer back down to zero after a book is done. Not way below the point of even thinking that I am even going to write another book. And little by little, these things kind of come back into my head and I think, well, gee, maybe I could write a book about that. But it's from the premise that I don't really ever have to write another book.
Is there a part of Frank Bascom that you most closely relate to?
Frank's notion in The Sports Writer that you can kind of go down on the ladder of cachet from being a writer to becoming a sports writer and ultimately becoming a real estate agent is, for me, something I strongly believe in. I think a lot of people would be happier if they quit aspiring and ascending at a certain point in their life and settled on something that they did that simply made them happy.
You grew up in Mississippi and Arkansas, and
yes.
And I think you still spend some time in New Orleans.
Yes.
But you have mostly, since your early work, left the South alone.
That's right.
How come?
Because other people do it better than I could.
You mean Faulkner or people now?
I mean Faulkner. I mean Eudora Welty. I mean Barry Hanna. I mean Buddy Norton. It's their natural subject. And when I was 30 years ago thinking about writing the first book I wrote, which was set in the South, I was thinking that I could write a book which would break the mold, which would be set in the South but wouldn't be thought of as a Southern novel. And the first thing anybody ever said and the last thing anybody ever said about it was another Southern novel. I really want to write books that will break some kind of mold, and I thought there's just no need for me to do this work.
I read that your grandparents owned this big hotel in Little Rock.
That's right.
That seems to me it must be, speaking of pantries of material, waiting for you to make a novel out of it.
It was a great way to grow up because it was sort of the Andy Eloise experience, really. It was a big old blousy drummer's hotel that also housed the state legislature when the legislature was in session in Arkansas. And all the governors, everybody came there all the time. And my first job was as a room service waiter. What more can I tell you? I mean, you get to see at the age of about 16 what adults do when they don't want to be seen doing it. And I saw a lot of that. You know, knock, 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 the door opens, here I am, and there they are. You see some interesting tableaus.
And has that become or will it become fiction?
No, I've written some essays about it. But I don't think, because it would be set in Arkansas, I still have the same little embargo in my heart against writing about the South.
So Arkansas counts, I guess.
Arkansas does count, I suppose. But apropos of you saying this, Kurt, I am going to write a little novel, which is set in Saskatchewan, about a man who runs a hotel out on the plains there. So maybe some little flecks of that experience of younger life could find their way into another book.
Did you, as a room service waiter, or before or after, did you read a lot?
No, I was dyslexic, and I read hardly at all. I had to learn seriously to read in my late 20s. I mean, I learned to read along with the other second graders, but I was slow to learn to read. Went all the way through school not really reading more than the minimum. I mean, I wasn't so badly dyslexic that I was disabled from reading. I just had to do it really slowly. And as I did, lingering on those sentences as I had to linger, I fell heir to language's other qualities, which I think has helped me write sentences.
You're saying the dyslexia made you slow down and actually have to go through the warp and woof of the language?
Exactly that, yeah.
You've been married for many, many years, longer than any
years.
Of us. Your wife, Christina, is, if not a collaborator, at least helps you out.
She helps me immeasurably, particularly and most specifically and recently, she helped me finish this book. She let me read it to her aloud.
As you're going or all at once?
All at once. We started last January and steady on, read it straight through, she with the manuscript, me with the manuscript, sitting across the room from each other in our apartment in New Orleans, right to the end. It's quite a gesture of affection.
But that's not just, here, let me perform for you, dear. It's an editing process?
Absolutely, because she's got a manuscript. And she'll say, read that again. Is that the word you want to use? She always helped me, though. We've read all these books aloud. Moreover, at the beginning of life, when I was just starting out as a writer, she said to me, look, I'll work. You stay at home and write. It's worth it for you to do this. And there's almost no greater gift you could give to a writer than the time to do his work.
I'm glad it's all worked out, both with the career and the marriage.
Well, I never think of writing as being a career, and I never think of my life with Christina as being a marriage. I don't have those sort of brackets, so it all kind of seems to fall under one rubric. I only do two things.
And this next novel about Canada, will it be a Richard Ford-ish book, or is this going to be a departure?
Well, I don't know, Kurt. I guess I think it's going to be a Richard Ford-ish book. I'm kind of left with that at this end of the stick, you know?
Thank you very much, Richard Ford.
Great to talk to you.
Richard Ford's new novel is The Lay of the Land, and it is in bookstores everywhere in America now. Coming up, does life imitate the movies?
If you're a Southern girl in my generation and you grew up with Scarlett O'Hara being so deeply ingrained in your psyche, you were Scarlett O'Hara.
Gone with the Wind and its hold on the American imagination. That's next up in Studio 360. From PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. So here's a perfect real-life American dream story. At the height of the Great Depression, a New York publisher is in Atlanta scouting for new novels. As he's about to catch his train home, a woman dashes up to him and forks over a stack of thick envelopes. The thing is 1,000 pages and such a mess that the publisher considers sending it back to her unread. Instead, he boards his return train, sinks into his Pullman car seat, begins reading, and encounters a story he can't put down. Gone with the Wind became, for a time, the second best-selling book next to the Bible. The movie followed a few years later, and it was a blockbuster all over the world as well. In this episode of our series on American icons, WNYC's Karen Frillman takes a look at why Gone with the Wind still moves us today.
Do you remember the actress?
Vivian Leigh.
Remember Vivian Leigh?
Yeah.
And who was the actor?
Clark Gable.
Clark Gable, you remember that, okay.
Yeah.
Was it in English or was it in Arabic?
No, in English.
This was in Basra, in Iraq.
Latif and Fouad Gigi ran a movie theater in 1945. The film ran to packed houses.
I remember the war. He went to the war. I remember he fell in love with her. I remember he beat her up. I remember.
Yeah. Well, are you sure they beat
her up? Yeah, he beat her up, yeah.
What you take away from Gone with the Wind seems to depend partly on what year you were born and how old you were when you saw the movie, and which side of the war between the states you were on.
The South had this fall from grace, and Southerners possess a knowledge of evil and a burden, even if they never committed that evil, you know?
Novelist Nancy Lemon from New Orleans says she used to watch the movie with her friends every Christmas Eve. She's seen it 26 times.
The Civil War is something very deeply ingrained in our nation, especially if you're the defeated party. Defeat hangs longer in the mind. You'll always find that the Yankees don't think about it that much because they were the winners, and you just go on. You don't sit around thinking, wow, I'm a winner. But you do sit around thinking, gee, I'm a loser.
God is my witness. As God is my witness, they're not going to lick me. I'm going to live through this, and when it's all over, I'll never be hungry again. No, nor any of my folk. If I have to lie, steal, cheat, or kill, as God is my witness, I'll never be hungry again.
Enter Margaret Mitchell's heroine, Vivian Leigh as Scarlett O'Hara.
She's just so amazing.
Like many movie lovers, Ben Grimwood can see the film over and over. An 18-year-old student at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee, he first saw the movie with his grandparents when he was 15.
There was just so much to Scarlett. The independence, she was so stubborn. She was her own woman, and Scarlett was definitely an amazing character.
If you're a Southern girl in my generation and you grew up with Scarlett O'Hara being so deeply ingrained in your psyche, you just thought you should be fascinating and have wiles.
I never can make up my mind which of you two's the handsomest. I was awake all last night trying to figure it out.
That you were Scarlett O'Hara, literally, until you finally realized that you should be Melanie, a person with a moral compass.
I like to feel that I belong to the things you love.
You love 12 Oaks as I do.
Yes, Ashley. I love it as more than a house. It's a whole world that wants only to be graceful and beautiful.
It's so unaware that it may not last.
Melanie and Scarlett, the two heroines, perform the values which seem to make this story so powerful. Melanie, who lovingly embodies the dream of Southern culture, and Scarlett, the survivor, who will lie, cheat, steal, or kill to save her family.
And they reel through the scenes from the Old South with the slaves in the fields, and it's just amazing. I get chills every time. The color is just majestic, and the acting is amazing, and like the things that they're acting about, portraying like the Old South when it was pre-Civil War, and then throughout the Civil War, and then the Reconstruction period, and it's just amazing to behold that kind of history.
Gone with the Wind gives us a very accurate portrait of a certain image of the South, which has little relation to reality, but what's interesting is how comforting and appealing generations of Americans have found this image of the Old South.
Eric Foner is the head of the history department at Columbia University in New York City.
And what's really interesting to the historian is the strength of the myth, which has lasted far longer than the world that gave rise to the myth.
Come on. Now you just stand still so you can be Christmas gift for the white folks. Hold on. Hold on. Don't go getting so uppity. Even if you is the last chicken in Atlanta.
any scene that juxtaposed a black person and a chicken's a really old scene. That goes back to Minstrel's Eve.
Pat Turner is a professor of African American Studies at the University of California, Davis, and the author of Ceramic Uncles and Celluloid Mammies. Turner says Gone with the Wind is almost a catalog of black stereotypes.
The most obvious example, of course, is Mammy, who in the film was portrayed by Hattie McDaniel. Dark complexion, overweight, highly sort of competent domestic worker.
Ooh! Just hold on and suck in.
Mammy, here's for Scarlet's pickles.
You can take it all back to the kitchen. I won't need a bite.
Oh, yes, and you is. You's going to eat every mouthful of this.
She admits the film has cultural significance partly because McDaniel did win the first Oscar for an African-American. But it was hard for her to watch Mammy and Scarlett together and think about what was not being said.
My mother was a black woman who cleaned people's houses for a living and supported us that way. My mother took care of white people's children, and she adored them, and she was wonderful with them, and she would have been just as supportive of them as Mammy is of Scarlett. But that didn't take away from the support that she gave to me and my sisters. And I always resented the absence of the rest of our family in these films that portended to show you what black women were like.
Flawed, but emotionally powerful.
They wanted to believe that that's the way it was.
Alfred Hunt is a Southern historian who taught at Purchase College.
There was this halcyon day of yesteryear when race relations were fine, when people had soirees in the evening, and all that sort of thing. And Gone with the Wind certainly perpetuates that myth.
The situation's very simple. The Yankees can't fight, and we can.
You're right. There won't even be a battle, that's what I think. They'll just turn and run every time.
One Southerner can lick 20 Yankees.
So I will finish him in one battle. Gentlemen,
the absolute joy, romanticism, the bravado of the Southerners, I think, was very real. But the fact is, you can't fight a war like that unless you have a very strong central government. Well, the irony of the Confederacy is it was seceded because they wanted to have a weak central government.
And just like today, the bravado gives way to confusion and loss. The defeat of the South was quietly tucked away, but not forgotten. Enter Margaret Mitchell, born in 1900. Anne Edwards, her biographer, writes that Margaret learned the letters of the alphabet to the names of Civil War battles. She was bounced on the knees of Civil War veterans to hear the story of the burning of Atlanta. She listened to her grandfather as she placed her hands on his scalp to feel his scars. The summer Mitchell was 11, she insisted on spending it picking cotton on her aunt's land. The story goes that it was from these black field hands that she learned for the first time that the South had actually lost the war. Alfred Hunt.
And as a result of that, the South, of course, having an un-American experience. It's the first time we'd ever lost. The loss of innocence in the South came with the Civil War. And so in that sense, a sense of perhaps of longing.
I only know that I love you.
That's your misfortune.
And Mitchell's genius may be that she encoded this history in a romance. The power of loss of love is familiar to everyone. Scarlett has her land, she's wealthy beyond her dreams, but the tug, the catharsis as it slips through her fingers, is impossible to deny.
If you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
And in that moment of self-realization, as she understands that she's just lost what she wants most, she holds it for a moment and then thrusts herself forward.
But I'll think of some way to get him back. After all, tomorrow is another day.
Maybe William Faulkner, in talking about the South, said it best. The past isn't dead. It isn't even past. His book, Absalom, Absalom, about a slaveholding family, came out in 1936, the same year Gone with the Wind did. But Margaret Mitchell beat him out for the Pulitzer Prize. For Studio 360, I'm Karen Frillman.
And I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. There is more about Gone with the Wind and all the other American icons we've featured on our show at studio360.org. If Gone with the Wind were remade today, I'll bet you the soundtrack would feature bars of music played on a certain musical instrument. Maybe you've never heard of a dobro, but you've undoubtedly heard it played. The dobro is a kind of guitar that's played with a slide as well as plucked with the fingers. The metal face on its body gives the instrument its signature sound, one that so strongly evokes old-fashioned country Americana. What you're hearing there is an Alison Krauss tune, and the man on dobro is Jerry Douglas. Over the last 30 years, Douglas has played on 1,000 songs recorded by artists like Paul Simon, Dolly Parton, John Fogerty, and he has won a slew of Grammys to boot. Well, now some of those big famous musicians have returned the favor by accompanying Douglas on his solo album, The Best Kept Secret. Jerry Douglas, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you. Thank you, Kurt. It's nice to be here.
So most of your career is spent backing up all these big-name stars. Is it harder for you to sit down and make a solo record?
It's much harder to make a solo album. Yeah. I mean, especially in the days when I was doing lots of sessions, you know, when you play on other people's records. And at the end of the day, you're just, you know, an extension of them. You're really not yourself anymore. So if you do that for 15 sessions a week for 10 years, you really have to wonder who you are.
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough to come up with melodies that you don't think you've heard before, you know, try to be original.
Well, since you have brought in one of your dobros today, I hope that means we're going to hear a Jerry Douglas song. What are you going to play for us?
The first thing we're going to play for you is a guy named Donald Lunny that's a great bouzouki player and baron player in Ireland.
What are those two instruments, if I may stupidly ask?
Bouzouki is a carefully pronounced instrument, but you don't. Yeah. Anyway, it's an eight-stringed, sort of a long stretched mandolin is what it looks like. Donald Lunny wrote this song about Pether O'Donnell, who was one of the revolutionaries in early Irish society. So I'll play a little bit of that one. How about that?
Thank you.
That was Jerry Douglas playing a tribute to Petter O'Donnell. And why don't we just cancel the rest of the show and have you keep playing? I could listen to you playing for the next hour more.
Well, that's nice, but we wouldn't sell many records just that way, would we?
Now, you, as people who haven't seen you or other dobro players perform, the instrument rests on your lap, which, Lord knows, if I were a musician, which I'm not, that would appeal to me more than having to do the guitar thing.
Yeah, you can't see the front of it when you play a regular kind of guitar.
You don't have to jump around. You don't have to act with it as a prop, as rock and roll guitarists do.
Well, I don't usually play it just sitting down with it on my lap. You know, most dobro players now have devised a way you can stand up with a strap and
be a regular,
be a rock star. Yeah.
How did you? How old were you when you started playing?
I was about 10 years old, and I heard a guy named Uncle Josh Graves, who played with Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs in the Foggy Mountain Boys, and they were, you know, people have heard them play on the Beverly Hillbillies and Bonnie and Clyde, you know, the Warren Beatty movie.
When you were about 10 years old.
Yep, that's about the time I heard them. But, you know, I was really into bluegrass music. And my father had a bluegrass band, and his whole band was comprised of guys who worked in the steel mills up in northeastern Ohio, who had moved up from the South and brought their music with them.
Kept their accents, judging by yours.
My accent. Well, if you're from Ohio, you have no accent. But after you move to Nashville, Tennessee, and live there for a while, this is the one you get.
Uh-huh.
I heard them play, and I was just immediately struck by the whole, you know, the sound of the instrument.
Tell me about the instrument. How is it different from an ordinary guitar?
Dobro guitars. Dobro is a brand name.
Now,
Dopera Brothers. There were five Dopera brothers in the early 20s that came over from Slovakia, not far from Bratislava, and they fell in love with Hawaiian music, but it wasn't loud enough for them.
Ukuleles were too little.
Ukuleles. You know, there were some beautiful slide guitars, you know, but it wasn't loud enough because their culture, you know, where they came from, things were loud, you know, oompa bands and accordions and horns and things like that. So they wanted it louder. So they created this metal contraption back here. It's like a speaker cone. And it's got a cover plate over, a shiny cover plate. And you can tell that this was all designed during the Art Deco period.
Or it looks like you could cook something on it.
Yeah, right. It looks like a little stove, a camp stove, yeah. But a lot of the things, you know, I don't know how they got so lucky in how they built these guitars, you know, and then there's one section of the guitar where there's more bass response than another and more treble response in another area. But they just got it right.
Well, let's hear another song. What are you going to play?
This is called Lil Roro. This is a song that's on the new record. Thank you.
thank you very much for playing and making my day.
You're welcome. I'm glad I could make your day.
Jerry Douglas's newest album, The Best Kept Secret, is available, and you can find out more about him and where he's on tour, maybe in your city, at our website, studio360.org. Coming up, a very, very different species of pop music performer.
There was Nick and Naomi Campbell and a guy named Bruno coming in with a platinum platter full of cocaine. And I said to my bass player, let's just try it. And then it just was all bad from then on.
The rocker Courtney Love. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Courtney Love is best known as the widow of Kurt Cobain, who led the groundbreaking band Nirvana in the early 90s.
I'm so happy, 'cause today found my friends in my head.
But Love has done plenty to make a name for herself. She's sold millions of albums with her former rock band Hole. She's been in movies, getting deserved acclaim for her role in The People vs. Larry Flint. And then there are the headlines about drug use and scandalous behavior of various kinds. Today, at age 42, Courtney Love wants to put all that hard living behind her, she says, and she's starting with a book. It's called Dirty Blonde, The Diaries of Courtney Love. It's a scrapbook of journal entries and photos and scribbled lyrics from her whole long, troubled life. Love told our producer Trey Kay that she wanted to share what she's been through without smoothing the reality into anything like a memoir. And even on good behavior, Courtney Love has some rough edges and salty language. So if you are listening right now with children, heads up.
When the sky was made of amethyst, and all the stars were just like little fish, you should learn when to go. You should learn how to say no.
When I heard Courtney Love scream on the first Hole album, it felt like she was reaching into my gut, grabbing my spine, then shaking me hard before throwing me across the room.
I am doll eyes, doll mouth, doll legs. I am.
In the video for the song Doll Parts, she sits on a bed in a white slip, strumming an acoustic guitar.
You know, someone once said to me, you know, you're that girl that the boys want to screw but then never tell their friends.
I'm not sure if I'm going to cop to that. But I will say that years ago, when Hole was popular and I was dating my wife Eleanor, she dressed up to look like Courtney for Halloween. And I kind of dug it. When her entourage whirled into our studio, Courtney whipped into rock diva mode.
Can I just have the f***ing coffee because I'm going to die?
Okay.
How hard is it to get coffee? We're in New York. It's like Coffee Central.
Courtney in person is kind of scary. I was afraid she might throw something at me like she did to obnoxious fans at her concerts.
All right. I'm going to go get coffee because if you don't do it yourself, it won't happen.
All right. I don't know what to do.
Finally, the latte arrived.
So we're rolling. Okay.
I'm wearing these glasses to look smart, but they're just bugging me.
Take them off.
So go back.
Look stupid. No, I'm just
dumb blonde.
So we're there to talk about Courtney's new book, Dirty Blonde. It contains diary entries from all parts of her life, her music, Hollywood, the relationship with Kurt Cobain, the scandals, drug abuse, lawsuits, and her childhood.
My childhood was Dickensian, to be mild. You know, we didn't have much gruel at the orphanage I grew up in.
Her book contains institutional records from when she spent about 2.5 years in an Oregon reform school. When she'd get out of line, the staff would take her to a place called the quiet room.
The last part's a really scary thing, because what they would do is they had tunnels underneath and they would put you in restraints, and then about 4 or 5 men would drag you into a room and they would restrain you.
Later, she transformed this frightening experience into a beautiful song.
You know, you can take the darkest hell and you can turn it into art.
Reading Dirty Blonde feels like finding a secret composition book. There are no captions or guiding text. Some places you have to work to understand what's going on. Around the middle of the book, there's a collage that appears to be 2 suicide notes. At first, I thought the notes were Cobain's. It turns out that they were written by Courtney after Cobain's suicide. Scrawled in red pen over the collage are the words, "I can't grow a new heart."
My decision to include what appears to be a suicide note from me, it looks like a suicide note, but I probably would never have done it. But, you know, I put it in there anyway. I almost didn't.
Shortly after Cobain took his life, Courtney launched into promoting Hole's debut album. Not long into the tour, the band's bassist died of an apparent drug overdose. During all of this, Courtney took little, if any, time to grieve.
I didn't go to a bereavement group or have psychiatric help. You know, I think that one of the reasons that it came around to bite me in the ass so many years later is because I never properly dealt with it, and it just festered.
I mean, did that drive you more into your drug use, or?
Yeah, less into creativity and more into drug use, yes.
But Courtney's career wasn't suffering. She made a splash as a co-star in Milos Forman's The People vs. Larry Flynt. And Hole's final record, Celebrity Skin, was considered one of the best albums of 1998. She left behind the grungy Seattle heroin scene and drank up the Hollywood lifestyle.
I'd be the girl that just didn't do coke. It just really grossed me out. And I got around fashion people. And then one night, I was sitting in a room. There was a Jackson Pollock on a wall and a Picasso on another wall and a naked Kate Moss and a naked Naomi Campbell and a guy named Bruno coming in with a platinum platter full of cocaine. And I said to my bass player, "Let's just try it." And then it just was all bad from then on.
When she was compiling her diaries, Courtney considered inserting a black page and writing the years 2000 through 2005. She calls them her darkest years. This is when she faced assault charges, temporarily lost custody of her daughter, Frances, and eventually went into drug rehab. How close was Frances to your drug abuse?
Actually, very far away. You know, I would go to hotels, or I would come to New York. The thing that really bugged Frances the most of all the public humiliations and scandals was when I got fat. That drove her crazy. When they said you can't tell the difference between Courtney and Britney Spears pregnant, that's the culture that we live in. Drugs? She didn't care about drugs. As long as I wasn't on them around her, she didn't care. Ever.
Courtney still writes letters to Kurt Cobain and tells him about the beautiful child they have.
I write him sometimes when I get really pissed off about stuff.
Do you feel kind of robbed that you don't have the chance to make this dialogue?
Yeah, what he did was really a terrible thing, what he did to her. And she is very aware of it. She wants nothing to do with the Nirvana business. You know, so the thing I've read about, you know, children who are victims of suicide is that they either take it upon themselves and blame themselves or they get angry. Thank God. I'd rather have her angry with him and pissed off at him than taking it out on herself, because her self-esteem is quite high.
I asked Courtney if she was bothered that her name would be forever linked to Kurt Cobain?
My name is going to be linked to Kurt's name, and it's going to be linked to other names, and that's just the way it goes. And okay, my name is going to be linked to my work and to the word stripper and to the word bitch and to the word idol and all sorts of words. And so, I mean, it's just part of my life.
When Courtney signed my copy of Dirty Blonde, she asked me if I would consider not talking so much about Kurt and Francis in my story. She wrote, "I am me, not who I'm related to." For Studio 360, I'm Trey Kay.
You can find pictures from Dirty Blonde and more about Courtney Love at studio360.org. Courtney Love said that you can take the darkest hell and turn it into art. And in fact, creative inspiration can pop up when an artist least expects it, even before he is an artist, as it did for the novelist Jonathan Safran Foer.
I was a freshman in college, and I was taking a sculpture course, as in making, not studying. But at the beginning of each class, we had a 10-minute slideshow. And over the course of the semester, we got this quick and dirty tour of sculpture, the history of sculpture. And I went up to the teacher after class, and I said, "Who was that artist with the boxes? What was his name?" He said, "Joseph Cornell." I went to the art library, looked at a book of his images. I tried to find other books. I tried to see the boxes in any museums that I could. For whatever reason, I don't know why, it struck me. Most of all, I wanted to make something that was like them. And in the beginning, I just imitated them. I actually made a whole bunch of Cornell box replicas. You know, I would take Da Vinci images. I would go to the National Gallery, where they have a wonderful Da Vinci painting, and they sell little posters and postcards. So right then, you have two sizes of the same image, and I would cut them out and apply those to... I remember one I made in particular, these little teacups my parents got when they on a trip to Japan. And I applied these images to these teacups, and I put them in a box that was supposed to be a photo album that I got on Hanukkah years ago and never used. And, you know, one thing leads to another, and then you have your own little replica, which is good for absolutely nothing. With Cornell, I felt like this was made for me. The effect that those boxes had on me was something I wanted to perpetuate, and I realized I could do it better not by imitating what he did, but by trying to find my own language. Cornell's work was very beautiful because it really inspired me. Beautiful things want to be replicated. That's what beautiful things are. That you see a beautiful person, you want to draw that person. Someone sees your drawing, they want to make a painting. Someone sees that painting, they want to take a picture of that painting. Someone sees your picture, they want to go for a walk in nature. So, you know, and it's this endless chain of people being excited by this beautiful thing that came before them. When I'm writing, I feel like 90% of what I'm doing is trying to stop making sense and create something that just has an effect, just is experiential. You know, my dream is for people to read my books, like on desert islands or at heightened moments in heightened places. Feeling that way about art, it's like a muscle. And once you know how to use it, you can use it more and it gets stronger. I didn't know what it was like really to love a work of art until Joseph Cornell came along.
Jonathan Safran Foer is the author of Everything is Illuminated and Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. If you'd like to see a lot of Joseph Cornell's work, there's an exhibit opening this month at the Smithsonian's Museum of American Art in Washington. Personally, I can't wait to go down. I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanks very much for listening to Studio 360 today. I hope you'll join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
David Krasnow,
Lital Malad,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Sarah Lilly,
Eric Malinsky,
Joseph McCannon,
Owen Agnew,
Blythe Sheldon,
Adam Walton,
Lori Ann Agnesi,
Brendan Baker.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegum. Thanks to Kay Capo for her help on our story about Gone with the Wind.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at CARE.org, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
If you like music by Moby, hold on. There is a lot more coming in the pipeline.
Got about 300 or 400 songs that I'm considering for the next record.
300 or 400?
Yeah. Pop music and R&B songs and dance music. Again, I'll never say I'm good at making music, but I'm prolific.
The musician Moby, next time in Studio 360 from PRI.
Thanks for listening to PRI's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. You can find out more about this episode and access our entire program archive at studio360.org.